Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Sally Kornbluth officially became the new leader of MIT this month. Her arrival means the university's president, provost, and chancellor are now all women. That's pretty remarkable for one of the nation's top schools for science and technology, fields where women remain severely underrepresented in the workforce. So what can an all-woman leadership team do about that? We sat down recently with the three leaders to ask. This weekend, the Boston Globe Spotlight team launched a series about sexual harassment allegations involving a former faculty member and graduate students at MIT. While our conversation with the president, Sally Kornbluth, Provost Cynthia Barnhart, and Chancellor Melissa Nobles happened just before the series was released, we touched deeply on issues of campus culture, representation, harassment, career growth, and research paths for women. And when we met in WBUR's Studio 5, I began by asking Sally Kornbluth, how does having women in the room change the conversation about science?
Yeah, you know, that's very interesting. I think there's a pretty strong literature that the more diverse your teams, including gender, but diversity among all dimensions, the more creative the team is, the more thoughtful the team is. And as we think about our research, we want to elevate the most important questions and bring the best minds and talents to the questions. And, you know, if we look at our population at MIT, but it's true nationally, we are seeing a generational change in answering these sorts of problems. So, for instance, we have nearly 50% women in our undergraduate student body, and I think it's like 38% or so graduate students are women. And then when you get to the faculty, it's about 25% women. Now, what we're hoping is that strong pipeline beginning in the undergraduate years, are going to move up and be the faculty members of the future. Now, when you talk about AI, you talk about health, et cetera, as you said, there's no question that bringing these diverse perspectives, bringing the woman's perspectives, are going to change the conversation. And what we want to do as educators is begin that conversation not only at the undergraduate level, but really all the way back to high school, middle school, et cetera, get the minds of women, well, girls and then women, thinking about these problems, encourage them, nurture them, and then bring them along. And I think one of the most important pieces of having women in leadership is not just bringing a diverse perspective, but honestly being role models so that girls see that there's a possibility for them to be doing the kind of high-tech, heavy research that MIT does. And so MIT puts a lot of thought, I think, into how they encourage that pipeline. And we as leaders want to continue to do that, but also be role models.
One, a lot of nodding from you, Cynthia, on two things. Cynthia is the provost of MIT. While Sally was talking, and some of that is, I get a sense that the three of you are just feeling really in that honeymoon lockstep together, and we're going to sort of not cite that. But also, you know, Sally said, we're hopeful that that pipeline is going to continue. And hope is great and not enough, right? So clearly, if this is a priority, you're taking steps to make sure that that nearly 50% undergraduate to under 40% graduate to under 30% in the faculty ranks changes over time. In your role as provost, what's the imperative? What do you have to do to help with that?
So many things you have to do. But let's start with the faculty. If you, as Sally said, if you look at the collective, right now about a quarter of our faculty are women. But if you look in the last 3 years, half of the women we've hired, half of the faculty we've hired are women. So there's a shift happening now in the world, and it's something we've been working on for decades, and that is be very proactive in identifying those different voices, different people with different perspectives and experiences and attracting them into MIT. For many years, we've had half of our undergraduate students are women. And I would say that the point Sally was making can be expanded in some way. I think that to continue to attract women into the pipeline, we need to really clearly continue to reiterate that when you, as a young girl, think about what it is you're excited about, interested in, and when you land on, I'd like to change the world, I'd like to do something that makes lives better for people, I'd like to make the connection that STEM is a way to do that.
You know, it strikes me there's a woman I know named Erica Ebel who graduated her undergraduate from MIT, has a PhD now, was Miss Massachusetts about 20 years ago. We actually talked to her about that recently. And in the early days when I first knew her, Melissa, one of the things that she talked about was as Miss Massachusetts, she would go out into classrooms. And as she talked to students in the like early elementary school who like science, everyone would raise their hand. And then there was a point as the girls got older in the classrooms when they stopped raising their hands.
Right.
So what's MIT's job in the pipeline before it ever gets to you, right? Before it ever gets to the freshmen, you got to get the applicants you've got, which means feeling empowered in the classroom and in the lab at 11, 12, 13. Does MIT have a job there, and what is it?
So one of the, we do in certain ways, and one is as my colleagues have said, kind of messaging out into the world that MIT is open to all and that we encourage women. And now we've got half of our class, nearly half of our class, undergraduates are women. So one is that our actual admissions reflects what we're seeing, right? Highly qualified students who are being accepted. But I think going back to answer your question about high school and such, we have certain of our students who do tutoring, right? So they're out there themselves, our undergraduates. There's a huge interest in public service. And some part of that is reaching back to the high schools, helping kids with math, helping kids with science. And those some number of those students are women. We have certain of our faculty who are involved in math Olympiads, which are looking at highly talented kids and getting them prepared. And that includes girls with an emphasis on kind of math camp for girls. And those students are encouraged to come to MIT preparing them. So we're sending out in the ways that we can signals that, yes, we want you here. B, our faculty and our students are helping to get you here and to prepare you. And whether you end up at MIT or not, we're also just seeding the inspiration that we've been describing, which is you can do it. We want you to do it. And if you come to apply to MIT, great. But wherever you go, right, know that these disciplines are open to you.
So let's do some of the hard parts now. Because you want to send a message that MIT is possible. It's not for the vast majority of people. Elite college institutions aren't. The admissions rates are well under 10%.
Yes.
The affordability is still a strain in terms of everyday expenses, going home to see family if you're low income, knowing how to navigate a campus if you're a first generation college student. And then there is on the research side, starting a family and having mentors who want to ask the same kinds of research questions that you do if they've had different lived experiences, et cetera. And I want to hit all those pieces. And I think, Cynthia, I'll come to you. I'm going to play you a little bit of sound. So Nancy Hopkins was a longtime faculty member in biology. She started working at MIT in the 1970s. She helped raise awareness of gender discrimination at the university. This is a recent documentary called Picture a Scientist.
I started publishing papers, and then I found you'd publish the papers and you would have trouble getting credit for the discovery. Everybody feels that way in science. Everyone thinks their work is undervalued, and everyone feels that way. But I thought, no, this is somehow different.
She famously took a measuring tape and measured footage of labs at MIT and found that women faculty members had less space. And then there was a 1995 landmark piece of research done by women faculty members that found junior faculty, people who hadn't been tenured yet, who were women, saw real opportunity, but women who had been tenured saw their life experiences as something that mitigated their growth. So if you tell me that all of that's gone now, I won't believe you because women in universities around the country and research are still talking about these problems. So what is better and what isn't? What do you still have to fix?
Well, let me say that there's great thanks among all of us at MIT now to Nancy and to the work that she did because big changes did happen. When I started as a faculty member at MIT in 1992, one of the first meetings I was called to was a meeting of the women engineering faculty. We happened to fit in a conference room. We don't anymore. But what was so interesting to me about that meeting was it started off talking about a problem that women faculty faced. That was not unusual. I'd been in meetings like that at another university where I worked before. What was surprising was the next step. The next step was talking about how we would fix that problem. And much of the confidence in our ability to fix the problem was the work of Nancy and her team. Because we knew that if we could identify the problem, quantify the problem, present a solution to the problem, and bring it to our administration, we had their attention, and we would have their help in fixing the
problem.
She
had created will.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So what still needs work?
You know, I think what still needs work is that, like any community, you have to create the community that works well together, that supports each other. You know, the thing that we see as we create, as we work to create this community of people with these diverse experiences and perspectives and backgrounds, is that we need, as a community, to understand how to tap into those differences and build from them. And one of the things I think MIT does well, but absolutely can do better, is we are good at removing barriers between disciplines in science and engineering and humanities, but we need to work on that more. There's always more that can be done to facilitate interactions and learn from each other.
I want to stay with the hard parts a little bit longer. And Melissa, Chancellor, I'll turn back to you.
Sure.
A 2019 study found that more than 18% of undergraduate women have experienced non-consensual sexual conduct since entering MIT. We have had a nationwide conversation about sexual assault on campus, about how much campuses should handle that themselves versus engage law enforcement, about whether girls and women are believed. I mean, this is a robust, we could do an hour just on that.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But 18% is a lot.
It is.
So what are you doing?
So after that report, we established the Institute Office for Discrimination and Harassment Response, which is an IDHR, which students can come and launch a formal complaint. And then we follow, of course, Title IX as required. And as you know, that changes. It's changed with each presidential administration.
Title IX creates a set of requirements
right.
for universities
yes.
to be responsive and has governed across the United States
exactly.
how universities react.
Precisely.
Sorry,
thank
go
you.
Ahead. Yeah.
So we're obviously complying with that. In addition to that, we have a wide set of educational activities for our students, right? So how to think about these things. And that office helps. We have a IDHR goes into the dorms, works with our heads of house who live in the dorms to sort through those things as needed. So it's trying to get change in the culture, which is as much what this is about, right? Kind of how students think about interacting with each other in a respectful way. What are proper boundaries? Which boundaries should and should not be crossed? And that is something that we're constantly working on. And the IDHR has been up now for about 3 or 4 years. It's robust in its responses. Students are satisfied. They come and talk. Oftentimes, it doesn't end up in a formal complaint, but it gives them an opportunity to talk about their experience and to get some feedback about that and how to, kind of understand what happened to them and how to think about it. So, you know, these are complicated issues for mature adults, right? We have young people coming into their own, learning, living alone by themselves and living in groups and communities. So it's that, and it's also part of the larger job that we have, as all universities have, of helping our students come into adulthood and living together in ways that are respectful and which are will further their education, both in the classroom and outside of the classroom.
Are you feeling, okay, so I'm going to ask you a student culture question, and at this point I'll just say I have two nephews that graduated from MIT. It was several years ago now, but I did have that experience of watching two young people go through
sure.
the university. Are you in a good spot with student culture around diversity, around open, honest communication, around mental health? Are you feeling comfortable that students are getting what they need from each other?
Yes, and we can always do better. We've put enormous energy and resources into mental health. We have a ton of our really extremely dedicated staff who work with our students. to help fortify their mental health, and student wellness is a big part of what we do. So yes, I'm feeling good about it, but to the degree that the outside context, the environment in which our students are living, the world in which we're living is upheaval, we can only feel so comfortable about our efforts because there's tons of disruption, and part of our job is trying to help them on the one hand negotiate that disruption, grow up, which is itself disruptive, right? Then think about the environment in which we're living, which is more volatile than perhaps we would like, and to thrive. So to answer your question, I'm feeling good as much as any person should reasonably feel good in my position.
Obviously, the other piece of legacy is dealing with the after effect with the MIT Media Lab, Jeffrey Epstein in 2019, who had was arrested in sex trafficking charges, died in jail in Manhattan in 2019. He had pleaded guilty to soliciting sex from an underage person in Florida back in 2008. It's 2023. You have taken over from a male president. Many changes have been made in the Media Lab and other parts of governance since then. In this moment, and to borrow a phrase from the name of an MIT initiative, how will you use your hand, your head, and your heart to do any remaining healing that needs to be done? And to, and I'm taking this and what the signals I've gotten from you, really boldly carve out new territory for the university, the student body, the researchers, the faculty.
You know, it's interesting. When I was even looking at this role, it was made very clear to me that anyone who's coming up to be president may have different initiatives, different ideas that they want to put forward. But what was most important to MIT in this moment was to make sure that their new leader was someone of integrity, honesty, transparency, that really would have an eye on the human component of MIT and the community. And so, you know, when people ask me what my vision is, the truth is I still have to really get to know the community before I can talk about specific programs, talk about specific initiatives. But what I can say now is that I want to be, first of all, a model of being truthful and transparent with the community to every extent that I can, but also people want to be seen, want to be understood. And so in this first 6 months to a year as president, I'm out doing a listening tour, hearing what people have to say, and really trying to understand and honor all the different constituent communities that make up MIT. And when you talk about something like Epstein, you talk about, you know, all universities, honestly, in the country have had some version of this, you know, more or less, not this particular circumstance, but, you know, crises or unfortunate circumstances that define a moment. And the important thing is, first of all, to live your values, to enforce your principles, your guidelines, and to move beyond it, to always strive to do better. And so I think MIT as a community right now really wants to come together to heal any differences and to really make sure that all constituents are seen and heard by the administration as we think about what we want to do going forward. So I actually feel good about that. I feel like people are ready, they're receptive, and, you know, it's not just me pronouncing what we should do. It's figuring out how we harvest the thoughts, the ideas, the feelings of the larger community. And my job as president now is to elevate those and honestly to make them coherent, to draw connections between the different constituents. And I feel very optimistic about that, not only in terms of my own dedication to those principles, but also to really the strengths of the team in honoring those ideas and commitments.
Are the three of you having fun working together?
Great fun.
Great fun.
All right. And on that note, Sally Kornbluth is the new president of MIT. Cynthia Barnhart is the provost. Melissa Nobles is the chancellor. They've all been here with us at WBUR. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.